You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm Sarah Custer, and joining me today is Phil Beatty, our Chief Knowledge Officer, and John Gill, our editor. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
So we are a few days after the World Academic Summit at the National University of Singapore. You guys were on stage for most of the event, so I'm curious to hear what some of your key takeaways were from the 3 days of discussions about the transformative power of research.
Well, where do we start? I mean, there was just so much, wasn't there? It's always a couple of days, two, three days. It seems like an awfully long way to go, doesn't it, for 2 or 3 days? But carbon footprint aside, I think there were huge numbers of really interesting debates that went on. For me, there were a couple of things I suppose I'd put out. One is there's a real sense in particularly in parts of Asia, I think, that lifelong learning has come of age. I think, you know, being based in London in the UK, where there's been a real sort of downturn in certainly part-time study, and you know, various funding mechanisms have actually resulted in fewer people studying as mature students and so on. I think that's completely at odds with what a lot of the world is doing, where they're really trying to sort of reorient universities away from being just places for young people to get a sort of, you know, 3 or 4 year degree under their belt that then sets them up for life, and understanding that you have to actually take concrete steps to help people navigate the very tricky waters that, you know, a career consists of these days. And I think for me, you know, just being at NUS, where they've done some really significant concrete things, for example, they've got this idea that you actually sign up as a student for 20 years. So yes, you do your degree, but then you're an enrolled student for 2 decades where you can come back and do things that will continue to update your skills. And talking to the heads of other institutions in that part of the world, whether it's somewhere like Singapore Institute of Technology, for example, I was talking on a panel with the president there, who's former provost of NUS, and he's actually orienting a whole institution around this idea of, you know, continuous professional development for a world where actually the skills that you need are changing all the time. I just think it's an interesting sort of different take on what a university is actually for. And I think there's, you know, parts of the world that are well ahead of some of the more established systems in getting to grips with it.
I think on that point, there was quite a lot in the summit that was really focused on, even though the focus was actually on research and the transformative power of research, there's a lot about teaching, there's a lot about the different requirements for teaching. I think there was this repeated mantra of constructive failure. The minister, the education minister of Singapore, talked about, you know, the stereotypes around Singapore's great at the factual knowledge, the STEM knowledge, they do well on PISA scores, but they lack creativity. So this whole lifelong learning idea, the idea that you're training for the fourth industrial revolution was prominent throughout. And a lot of people talked about constructive failure, integrating into systems, the ability and opportunity of getting things wrong and screwing up that they're sort of missing in their creative process. But then that also was something that Brian Schmidt touched on in his keynote. So Brian Schmidt, the president of ANU and Nobel Prize winner, he was really concerned about increasing separation of teaching and research in universities, and obviously going back to that fundamental idea that for this future world, when you're trying to instill creativity, instill resilience, and make failure a constructive part of learning, he was really worried about the separation of teaching and research, in the sense that actually research needs to inform even undergraduate teaching, because students do need to learn problem solving, they need to learn how to tackle problems that they haven't confronted yet, problems that don't exist yet. So there was actually a theme running throughout of the whole conference about how important it is to sort of reinvent teaching as part of this vision.
Yeah, I thought, I mean, that struck me as well. Brian Schmidt, who gave a brilliant keynote actually, a really wide-ranging one, was quite apocalyptic in his view of the sort of breakdown of research and teaching. I think part of it was, if we talk about research-informed teaching, we have to understand what that really means and what that really delivers for students, rather than just, you know, wheeling it out as some sort of glib thing that we all like to think is important. You know, is it important to students? Do they understand what it is? Do they understand why it's important? And, you know, his worry was that if you actually have this sort of division of labour, so you have teaching-only institutions and then research institutes, you know, that might work for the first generation of students who are still getting teachers in their teaching only institution who have been through research informed undergraduate education themselves and understand what research is. But after a couple of generations, you will have people that have never even sort of, you know, sniffed a laboratory or know what research is teaching, and then you've broken the link. And he was really, and interestingly, in one of the panels that I was chairing as well, I sort of brought this up again, and Michael Spence, who is the Vice Chancellor of the University of Sydney, was echoing Brian Schmidt, really saying this is a really, really big problem. You know, we have to take it seriously. So the nice thing about the summit is I think you get a sense of what, you know, some of the world's absolute sort of, you know, leading thinkers on where higher education is going are actually sort of genuinely lying awake worrying about, and that seemed to be one of them.
Yeah, there's this perfect like synchronicity, because after Brian Schmidt said that, then there was also the principal at the University of McGill, Suzanne Fortier, who came out saying that there's this tension between industry and universities and this real war for talent. And I feel like that was a theme that a lot of people talked about, and it was quite frank conversations about that. And then we had the guy from Microsoft who was on the same panel with Suzanne saying that the developments in AI are basically standing on the shoulders of 60 years of work the academics have been doing in researching these new technologies that we're only now becoming to see the benefits of. Were there any other themes that you guys felt were really kind of brought up throughout the whole discussion?
I mean, we're very clear that these summits are not ranking summits, but obviously we did release the world rankings at the summit, and they informed a lot of conversation. So there was quite a lot of threads relating back to rankings. One, of course, we had a bit of a barnstorming speech from Tony Chan, the president for the last decade of Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, who's now moved across to Kaust in Korea, the sort of postgraduate... Kaust in Saudi Arabia. So the fact that he's moved to Saudi Arabia to try and replicate what they've been doing in China for the last two or three decades, and I thought that was interesting in the sense that he charted the rise of China. We've seen that in the rankings last week. But one of the things he was saying in relation to Saudi Arabia is Saudi Arabia is now increasingly looking east instead of west, because they actually look where the talent is, look where the change is. And traditionally, there's a few people making this comment that traditionally the Middle East would always defer to the West for their model, for their inspiration, and that's changing.
I think, I think the other thing that, because that was a session that I was chairing, and I put to Tony Chan that actually this idea of a reverse brain drain with sort of, you know, all these really talented Chinese researchers that have come to the West to study and do postdocs, they're now potentially being lured back to China. Is there any sense that maybe they're going back to China being slightly disillusioned that it's not, you know, quite what they thought it would be, and then drifting back to the West? And he said, well, A, the evidence for that isn't here yet, so, you know, be jumping the gun to say that. But B, even if they do, that's not really an issue, because, you know, the whole world of academia is so fluid and global now. People should be moving in both directions. He said, you know, he went to America as an academic. I think he was at UCLA for a long time, then went back to Hong Kong, which I believe is where he's from, led Hong Kong UST for many years. Now he's left again. That doesn't mean that he thinks it's because Hong Kong or sort of Asia is not the place to be. It's a very fluid world that we live in, and I think, again, that's a really good timely reminder, especially for those of us in London who sort of are staring down the barrel of the Brexit gun, you know, a reminder that actually this is the world we're in now. There's no going back from a world that's truly global in higher education.
Yeah, and I also think that speaks to just the rise of Asia, that Asia is now on one of those bus stop tours in an academic's career, is that it might be the US, then it might be Asia, and then it might be back to the US, and then it's quite equal in terms of the academic mobility. And that was something that Kishore Mahbubani, a professor in the practice of public policy at the National University of Singapore, that was a point that he brought up in the panel, was that Asian universities, their rise is thanks to the success of Western universities, but now really in the Asian century, who are they going to look to make the progress that they've been making? And is it going to be Western universities, or are they going to turn around and look at their peers?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually just to plug the Times Higher Education Asia University Summit, we made quite a bold decision. We're actually running the Asia Summit at Khalifa University in the United Arab Emirates. And I think one of the reasons we did that is because we thought actually the far west of the Asian continent is a really interesting place to be, in the sense of the Middle East has a huge challenge of building capacity around research and education. It has a lot of money. It's very conscious of investing in research and innovation to move away from the dependency on natural resources. And actually this idea that there'll be lots of Middle East China relationships growing in terms of research and knowledge, the whole Belt and Road Initiative. So we're very focused on understanding the sort of changing geopolitics of Asia by having the summit next year in the Middle East. And I think that's reflective of a real shift of priorities, and people in the East still looking west, but looking west within their own continent.
I also asked some delegates what they will be taking home to their institutions after the three-day event, and here's what they had to say.
My name is Mamo Khetipaking. I'm the Vice Chancellor of the University of Cape Town.
President Paking, we're here on the final day of the World Academic Summit here at the National University of Singapore. What are you going to take back to Cape Town after these 3 days of discussions about the transformative power of research?
I think this conference provided an opportunity for me, out of my busy schedule at work, to take time to first of all understand the kinds of resources that THE offers, that I've never had the time to sit down with the people from THE to talk about them, and I've had the opportunity to do that, but also an opportunity to have much more detailed conversations with other presidents of other universities. Without having to travel to their their campuses, and I think that's been the biggest take, because I can go back home and pick up conversations from there. You know, some of them hand over to colleagues who will take over, who will proceed with them with the institutions at home. So it's been useful in that way, but also understanding what getting to know what other universities are doing. With the challenges that will be that are posed by the emergence of the fourth industrial revolution, different universities are doing different things, and so it's important to know those universities that have started some initiatives. How are they working? What's working? What's not working? To learn about different models of education. I mean, I think there's interesting to learn, for example, about what the Minerva project is doing, which I wouldn't have had necessarily the opportunity from. But it's different reading about the project to hearing the founder talking about it and having an opportunity to ask him questions about it. So it's been useful in that way, that to see what is it that you're doing and how other institutions, top performing institutions in the world, are doing things. So there's lots of instruction that I got out of here.
And you're quite new to your position. You've only been president of the University of Cape Town for a few months. Is there one thing that you're going to definitely go home with and implement immediately at your institution that you've learned from the summit?
Well, it's been 88 days, by the way, in office. At universities, you can't just take something and implement it immediately. But one thing that I will take immediately, I mean, it's costly, of course. But I like the data offer for the THE data offer. That's one thing that I'm sure that we need in terms of strategy and planning moving forward. That I think it's a kind of resource that I would like us to have before the end of the year. So that's one thing I'm definitely sure, because it will involve just talking to the executive and moving with it from there. I think in universities generally, things that involve faculties and so on, you have to share with them, and they've got to buy into them, because they are going to be implementing them. So there are things that I'll be talking to colleagues in the faculties about, and also just having stronger connections with the universities in Singapore. It's not something that we have as part of our key collaborations, and having seen what they do here at NUS. It's one thing that I thought, you know, first of all, I want to know whether we have a signed partnership agreement with NUS. Can we connect with them, particularly in terms of their student entrepreneurship initiatives, and see how we build on that. So as an immediate thing, Those are the two that I can confidently say we will immediately start talking about them at the university. Other detailed things will need to be negotiated with the faculties.
Mm. UCT was announced last night that you are the number one institute in Africa based on the 2019 Times Higher Education World University Rankings. Mm-hmm. And we were just reminded in the session just now about the massive demographic shifts that we're going to see in the next 80 to 100 years, and it's really going to place Africa at the epicenter of population growth. So I'm just wondering, what is your opinion of how we're going to see the transformative impact of research play out through an African lens?
I think being announced as the top university in the continent is a wonderful thing, as much as it's a huge responsibility in terms of what you do and how you do it to benefit the continent. The challenges of our future, which also have to do with population growth and the age profile of our continent, together with the fact that the young people of today are not the same as young people of the past. That means we as a university, firstly, we will have a huge opportunity, but also a big challenge of ensuring that our education prepares our young people for the challenges that the changes in this world bring. But we can also draw on that population growth as an advantage. I mean, I think that development is going to force the world to, and universities in general, higher education in general worldwide, to pay attention more to the needs of the continent, because I can see that more universities elsewhere in the world recruiting students from Africa, whether to study online or face to face. I think it's going to challenge, because everyone will need students, and the students will be mainly, majority of students will be from in Africa or in Asia, and so it's going to change how we teach, because the student body will look different, or the student population will look different, but I think it will be an advantage for us, because we would have been doing it for many years, and so we will have a competitive advantage, but we'll be able to be a resource to other institutions in the world.
I'm Tan Eng Chai, President of National University of Singapore.
First of all, thanks so much for hosting us here these 3 days for the World Academic Summit. My question for you is, what are your key takeaways from the discussions?
Well, we have had very interesting discussions, very inspiring lectures, as well as very engaging, stimulating discussions and dialogues. For me, all these discussions does affirm the pivotal role which research universities do in shaping the minds of our graduates, communities, societies, and nation. And further, we can enhance this impact by making sure that we collaborate with governments, industry, community organizations to enhance the entire research and innovation ecosystem.
There has been a lot of talk about that ecosystem, but it's often in the context of a tension, or I think someone described it as a friction this morning. In your experience at NUS, have you felt that friction, and what are you doing to try to overcome it?
Well, not quite friction. I wouldn't call it friction. I would say challenges. So the ecosystem has many aspects, right? The fiscal aspect, where people would need a physical entity, or maybe sometimes a virtual entity, in order to connect with one another. And then the second aspect is the talent aspect, right? And it's actually a whole suite of talents. If you are talking about innovation system, you are talking about researchers, you are talking about innovators, entrepreneurs, the venture capitalists, and the many other expertise in between that are needed to support the ecosystem. And importantly too, there is this social capital, which is the connections. So no innovation hub survives by its own, unless of course some are tremendous. But I think the external connection, the international connection, all these are very important. So the ecosystem is actually a complex thing, but it is an essential thing. You can't imagine that by just tweaking one particular factor of it, you can expect to change a lot. All right, so a lot of things is actually you need to tweak many factors at one time in order to even move the needle on the ecosystem. So it's complex, it's challenging, but I believe it can be done.
Jenny Dixon. I'm Deputy Vice Chancellor Strategic Engagement at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. And my role encompasses what you might describe as external affairs. It includes all things international, alumni relations and fundraising, stakeholder engagement within New Zealand and Pacific strategy, and those sorts of things.
Great. So here we are at National University of Singapore for the World Academic Summit. Jenny, it's the end of day three. What are you going to go back to Auckland with after these 3 days of discussions around the transformative power of research?
This is the first time I've been to this conference, so I wasn't quite sure what to expect, but I've been delighted in terms of the range and quality of the sessions. Of course, it's always about the networking, so I've caught up with some old friends and I've made new ones, which I'm delighted about, and of course, and we're all talking about the issues that are central to universities' performance and research performance, so that's been very useful and insightful. I've also found it very good to hear about how various countries are performing in the rankings and what's going on and why. That's been very useful to understand.
Was there any one country that surprised you, whose performance surprised you in the rankings?
Not necessarily, but it was certainly very insightful, just to get that sort of analysis and breakdown that you don't always pick up when you're reading things on screens. The other thing that I thought I really enjoyed was that during outside the main program, there were various presentations that you could go to during the lunch break and or early in the morning and so on. And I think that was actually very good as well.
One of the big points for me that's come up over these 3 days is the tension. Some people have called it a friction between this partnership that universities have with industry and also with governments, and the University of Auckland has a pretty unique offering in that sense. Can you tell me a little bit more about the project that you've just set up?
Oh yes, one new initiative that the University of Auckland really helped drive was the Entrepreneurship Fund, where government and any of the 8 New Zealand universities share the costs of bringing entrepreneurial academics along with their labs and research groups to New Zealand. And that's been, I think this is an important breakthrough for universities, because there really is such competition for global talent, and in New Zealand it's often very difficult to match salary expectations. So in this way, with government support, we are now able to bring various people whom we've identified through, kind of exhaustive searches, who are going to bring particular skills and expertise to our university, which is really going to add value to the offerings that we have.
That's quite unique to have government so much on your side. Is that something that the universities in Auckland really lobbied for, or how did that come about?
Well, there was there were obviously discussions put forward, and I think and governments never necessarily take up the full gamut of what you might propose. But that was a really good initiative, and I mean it isn't perhaps on the scale that we'd like, but nonetheless it's a start. And this is in a country where there isn't a huge amount of government investment in universities, so it's quite an important step for us.
Your current government is really pushing for a no fees agenda. How do you think that's going to affect the University of Auckland's ability to create transformative research?
Well, I think we've only seen the first year of this policy, which was introduced this year for all new students coming into the university system. And the plan is to introduce it so that all students will have their first 3 years funded. That's going to take another two election cycles, I think. Our view of it is that it doesn't appear to have made a great deal of difference in terms of enrolments, and particularly the University of Auckland has the highest entry standard. So I think from the university's perspective, it's a challenge, because it means that money diverted to students is money that could have otherwise gone to actually help research performance of universities. And so that's just something that we've got to live with.
It's kind of like the government giveth and the government taketh away if it's created this entrepreneurship program, but then it's taking away tuition fees.
Well, I think it's just one of several things that the governments get involved in, and they've made a commitment as part of their election strategy. We now have to work with what we've got. We do obviously talk a lot with government and opposition politicians, and that's part of my portfolio. So we're often, we'll have conversations that may lead to initiatives, and we just have to take it in the way that we see sort of some advantage.
And those were comments from delegates at the 2018 World Academic Summit in Singapore. John and Phil, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Sarah Custer, and we'll see you next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.